Can you imagine the level of a mind that watches wrestling?
The audience wants to see action, adventure, wrestling, and plenty of it.
Big men in tights, you know the drill.
Rammer Slammer.
Welcome to Rammer Slammer. I am Ben Flanagan, and we have a very special episode today. Today, I'm talking to Eric Bischoff. We had a great opportunity to talk with Eric, and as you probably know by now, he has a brand new podcast with our good friend Conrad Thompson. The show is called 83 Weeks with Eric Bischoff. It's available wherever you can download podcasts. New episodes arrive on Sundays, and it's been terrific. Four episodes in, and it's just already so fascinating. It's essentially the equivalent to Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard, just the WCW version, from the perspective of Eric Bischoff, who's obviously one of the most polarizing figures in WCW history, certainly wrestling history, I should say, just in general. He left a huge mark on the business, obviously, from creating the NWO and taking the WCW company to heights that it had never previously known, even surpassing WWF and WWE and pushing it to its limit and really sort of inspiring it to grow beyond where it was to become even bigger and eventually purchase WCW and become the professional wrestling company that we know today. So it was fascinating talking to Eric Bischoff about his career, how he got to know Conrad, how this podcast got started, some of the stuff that he did in WCW and since then, and in his relationships with Vince McMahon, his relationship with Ted Turner. We covered a lot of ground, and it was an honor to talk to him. I think we're all obviously huge fans of a lot of what he did with WCW and later with WWE. So he's a big deal in the business, and it's awesome that he and Conrad are working together now and giving us this amazing podcast. Highly recommend it. Check out every episode. They're all great, and we look forward to seeing what they do in the future together. So here's our chat with Eric Bischoff. Thanks so much to him for making the time for us. It was a fascinating talk, and I hope you enjoy it. Eric Bischoff, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm a huge fan of the new podcast and can't wait to see where it goes from here. I think it's been great so far. And the first thing I want to ask you, during your WWE debut in 2002, I believe it was, before Vince McMahon introduced you, he said, "It takes a real son of a bitch to be successful in this business." And I'm curious about that quote. How do you look back on that line specifically, and how much truth do you think that there still is to that in terms of being successful in the business?
Wow, that's a good question. You know, I don't reflect back too much on moments in my career. One, because there's so many of them that, you know, fortunately for me, we're kind of important moments at the time and critical moments, but I'm not the type of person that lives in the past. Quite honestly, I try to focus on the day, the moment, if you will. Try not to think too much about the future, but to a certain degree, you have to. But I'm not one that lives in the past. I just don't reflect back. But as I think back on that particular line, and I think it's very true today, it's relevant today, and I think it's probably true in almost any business. You know, look at, you know, the entertainment industry is, in general, now not just wrestling, is become so competitive. The television business, by virtue of what's happened to streaming and the growth in the streaming category, has really turned the traditional television business upside down. And as a result, look at how tough politics are in today's environment because of, in many respects, social media. So I think there's been so many changes in just about every form of business today that you've got to be tough. You've got to be aggressive. You don't have the luxury of a slow, deliberative, kind of an analytical process if you want to stay on top of your game. You have to be very nimble. You have to be very aggressive. You have to take bold chances. if you want to survive. And I think that's particularly true in the wrestling business, sports entertainment in general. It's a very, very competitive business from the business side of things. And if you're a talent in the WWE or anywhere, if you're an independent talent, you've got to work as hard as you can, as fast as you can to stay on top or as close to the top as you can get, because on any given day, an injury can take you out of the game and your entire career can get sidelined or worse. You could be put out of the business. So I think anytime the stakes are as high as they are, as I said, in business in general, in entertainment in particularly, and given the nature of what professional wrestling is, the injury factors involved, even more so, I think you do have to be a son of a bitch. However one would define son of a bitch, I tend to define it as a very committed, aggressive, take no prisoners kind of attitude. And I think that's very appropriate, and maybe even more so today than it was in 2002.
Well, and sort of in that same arena, you mentioned performers and how difficult it is for them to not, like, regardless of like being on top, to even break into the business at that level. In your episode about Bret Hart last week, you said that despite any animosity that might exist between you two, you have a lot of respect for someone who can not only have success in the business but make a good living for themselves in it, because it's basically next to impossible for people to do that. Like, what specifically makes the business so difficult to even penetrate, and do you think that it's any harder or easier in 2018?
You know, if you'd have asked me that question 6 months ago, I would have said it's definitely harder, because for the most part, there's really only one place to work. There's one employer, and that's WWE. And given that there, 6 months ago, a year ago, there were no options. And if you wanted to break into the business in any meaningful way, I mean, you could wrestle as a hobby, as an independent wrestler, and again, context a year or two ago, if you were on the independent scene, if there were probably fewer than 5% of the independent wrestlers in the United States a year or two ago that were able to make anything that resembled a livelihood in the industry. Everybody else was doing it as a hobby, almost a paid hobby. But you certainly weren't paying a mortgage and taking care of a family and investing in your future based on what you could make on the independent circuit. So to be specific in trying to answer your question, a year or two ago, yeah, it was incredibly, difficult, if not almost impossible, to make a good living in the wrestling business, primarily because there was only one employer. There were only so many spots on that roster and a tremendous amount of talent all competing for those positions. So inherently it was difficult. I think what's changed now is, and we've seen it just in the last, couple of weeks, with the success of the All In event that's taking place in September in Chicago. It's an event that Cody Rhodes, a second generation wrestler, very young man, the Young Bucks, very, very young guys who have been doing well on the independent circuit, decided to take destiny in their own hands, and they promote an event in Chicago that sold 10,000 tickets in less than 30 minutes. Now, just to kind of, by comparison, if you look at WWE's, quarterly SEC reports, their average attendance at non-televised events are probably 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people. And for an independent company, especially two guys as young, or two teams as young as Cody Rhodes and the Young Bucks, to just decide they're going to go ahead and launch an event, a first-time event in Chicago, which is a traditionally tough market, and sell out 10,000 seats, tells me that there's a future in the industry for independent wrestling. And that it's growing, and as it continues to grow, it will be easier, not easy, but easier for some people to break into that industry and to at least make a reasonable amount of money doing so. But that's a new thing. Once WCW, was sold to WWE, and it essentially became a, I don't want to say a monopoly in the legal sense of the term, but a monopoly in the practical sense of the term. And WWE obviously controlling that monopoly, you know, the chances of making it in the wrestling business were very, very minimal. Look at the music industry. And I like to make analogies sometimes because it's easier for people to kind of put things into perspective, because not many people know much about the wrestling business. They don't really know how it works. They can't really put it into context. But, you know, think of how many great musicians there are in the world, in the United States. Okay, in Alabama. Great musicians in Alabama that nobody's ever going to hear of unless they get their, you know, their lottery ticket moment, you know, on a show like The Voice, for example. How many great musicians have come out of that show that until that show nobody had ever heard of before? Doesn't mean that they were any less talented. It just means they hadn't gotten the exposure. And I think, I don't know what the statistic is for sure, but I think, you know, probably 1% of the musicians that are out there in the United States make 99% of the money. And everybody else is playing because they're passionate about it. And they're passionate about the music. Same is kind of true with professional wrestling. Same is also true for actors and actresses. Probably 2% or 3% of all the actors, you know, that we all know about are making 90% of the money. Everybody else is doing it because they love it. And I think that's very, very similar to professional wrestling. That's a long-winded way to answer your
question. No. It makes a lot of sense. And you mentioned that a lot of people don't know a lot about how the wrestling business works. And in the episodes of 83 Weeks that we've heard so far, you're obviously very critical of information people have come by second or third hand, like the second or third hand information they get, people who weren't actually there, they don't have direct knowledge. Why is it important to you? How important is it to you as someone who is actually in the room for a lot of the stories that you tell and stories that people are reporting on? Why is it important to you to sort of set the record straight for people?
It's not really that important to me. You know, despite what you may hear, you know, the fact is, you know, Conrad, and it's one of the reasons why Conrad is so incredibly successful in such a short period of time in the podcast industry. You know, Conrad does his homework. Conrad does his research as well as does his team. And as a fan, and that's how Conrad comes at professional wrestling. He comes to it from the perspective of a fan. He doesn't pretend that he knows the facts. He doesn't pretend that he was there. His questions are from the perspective of what fans generally have come to know through publications that I refer to sometimes as dirt sheets or through, you know, online sources or basically information that's out there in the public domain that has been produced by people who are doing nothing but trying to, it's clickbait. And, you know, if I get hot with Conrad during a podcast, it's not really, I'm not getting hot because of the way something that someone has said affects my life, because it doesn't. But what does get me upset is a lot of the commentary that has been produced, the clickbait, if you will, and I say that very generally because a lot of the stuff that Conrad brings up was before the internet. You know, we're going back into the 90s when there were publications that came out once a week called dirt sheets that spread the rumors and innuendo. But I remember specifically how some of that misinformation and outright nonsense that was just created out of thin air had an adverse impact on the business, and it affected people's lives, not just mine, and in many cases, not mine at all. But when you work for a big company like Turner Broadcasting, for example, when I did, and you see how corporate executives who really don't know much about the wrestling business, even though they own a company, that's a professional wrestling company, they really don't know much about it. They don't really know why it works. All they know is that it's popular. And when those executives relied upon third-hand information that was based on second and third and fourth-hand information or opinion or perspective, and you see how that manifests in decisions and choices and perspectives that had an adverse impact on the business itself and the people that work there, it gets me hot. It still does to this day when I hear some of that stuff. Again, not because of how it affected me necessarily, because in many cases it didn't. In some cases it did. But it hurt the business in general. And that's the chip that I carry on my shoulder when those kinds of questions come up, because I know how adversely they impacted, you know, the industry in general.
Sure, and you mentioned Conrad comes into this from the fan's perspective, and he's obviously a guy with zero background in the business, and he's emerged as this new and respected voice, and obviously in the podcasting industry. You mentioned how successful he is, and it's obviously in large part to people like you and Bruce Prichard who share your stories so candidly. I know that you can't speak for Bruce and only yourself, but why are you so willing to answer Conrad's tough questions and criticism, even though he's never worked in the business?
Because here's what makes Conrad really work. And I'll be specific to me, why it works for me. Because as tough as Conrad can be, and sometimes he's brutal. I mean, sometimes he just drills me. But he's doing it based on a perception or information that was published by somebody else. He's asking me to respond to criticism from somebody other than him. He's not criticizing. In some ways, he does. And when he does, it's because he's calling out BS, right? And those are those moments during the course of the show. I just got to go, yeah, you're right. And I got to eat that one. That did happen. That was stupid. I made that mistake. But he's not coming at it from, Eric, this is my opinion. Why did you do that? It's, Eric, here's what so-and-so wrote, and here's my take on it, but what the hell? Tell me the truth. What was going on then right there? So because of the way he approaches his material, it makes it easier for me to open up about it and let him in. He's not criticizing or critiquing firsthand. He's presenting the information that's been out there in the public domain and wants a response. That's a little bit different than, hey, I'm the smartest guy in the room, and even though I've never been in the wrestling business or ever, you know, produced, you know, 30 seconds of a television show, here's what I think you should do. That's not his approach, and that's why I respect him.
Well, and can you tell me a little bit about when you first met or heard about Conrad? How did this working relationship begin?
Well, actually, when I say actually, I guess apparently Conrad had approached me a couple of years ago at a autograph signing or an event of some sort, a Comic-Con or something, I don't recall, and introduced himself and asked me if I'd be willing to come to Alabama to sit down with him and a couple of his very close friends who were, you know, hardcore wrestling fans, longtime wrestling fans, and just do kind of a private Q&A. And at the time, number one, I didn't know who Conrad was. And number two, that kind of thing just didn't, you know, appeal to me. I don't like to travel in the first place. I resist traveling at every opportunity. But, you know, because I didn't know him and I had never done an event that was kind of like a personal private Q&A and didn't really know what to expect, it just didn't seem like something I wanted to do. So I politely, I hope politely, because I don't remember it. But I passed one way or the other. Whether it was polite or not, I don't know. But I passed. And then shortly thereafter, Bruce Prichard, who is a good friend of mine and has been for many years now, told me about, you know, he had done the same thing. Conrad had approached Bruce and asked him to be a part of that, you know, private Q&A. Bruce did. Bruce and Conrad developed a great relationship. Bruce started working with Conrad in the mortgage industry. And at some point, Conrad convinced Bruce, I'm not sure about the timing, but at some point in the middle of that relationship, as it was evolving, Conrad convinced Bruce to do a podcast. And the rest is history.
And so you're from Michigan, correct?
I was born in Detroit, and I lived there until I was about 14 or 15.
Okay, I got you. And obviously, you spent a lot of time in the South in working for WCW and obviously traveling and with the company. I'm just curious, why do you think the South was such a fertile ground to help launch and expand what was obviously before all the enormous success you guys had, a modest promotion? Why was it able to launch and expand into the top wrestling company in the world? Why was that region a good place to start?
Well, I mean, legacy, number one. You know, the South has always been, you know, a very popular market for professional wrestling. And part of that is because there are a lot of small towns that are geographically very close to each other. So that as a wrestling promoter, whether it was going back to the NWA days in the Carolinas or Eddie Graham down in Florida or Bill Watts in the Mid-South area, the South and the Southeast, you know, because of the way this country evolved and was settled, there's just a lot of very, you know, a lot of good markets, solid markets with enough of a population where as a promoter you could tour your live events and be able to cover, you know, four or five towns a week, six towns a week, without having to drive all the way across the country to do it. The same is true in the Northeast. It's another reason why the WWF back, you know, three generations ago was such a prominent wrestling organization in the Northeast, because you had a lot of small markets, small towns that were relatively close to each other so that a promoter could actually tour their events and cover a lot of ground and make a lot of money without having to drive across the country. I think culturally, one of the reasons I think, you know, professional wrestling worked in the Northeast is because of the density of, you know, blue collar workers. I'm going back now three generations to Vince McMahon's great grandfather or grandfather. I can't remember which, but you know, going back in that time, you know, professional wrestling was blue-collar entertainment. It was affordable. It was live. You know, back, this was before concerts and country music tours and Rolling Stones and Fleetwood Mac. I'm aging myself here. But, you know, it was before touring music really was as popular as it has become. Professional wrestling was one of the few real live events that would come on a regular basis to small markets that appealed to a blue-collar audience in the Northeast, and I think the same is sort of true in the Southeast. It's one of the reasons why professional wrestling, although it was popular in the West, it had a difficult time, you know, having the same type of success, because, you know, you had to go from, you know, you had Los Angeles, you had San Francisco, you had Salt Lake City, and then you had an 18-hour drive to get to Denver, you know, or a 14-hour drive to get to Seattle. It was really difficult because geographically things were spread out so much more as you got farther west.
How would you describe working with Ted Turner? What was your most memorable encounter or conversation you had with him?
Well, the most memorable, obviously, is the conversation I had with him when he looked me in the eye and said, "Eric, what is it going to take for us to be competitive with the WWE? It was a question that I hadn't prepared for, the question that I hadn't expected would ever come my way. It was a question that was 180 degrees opposite of what we were there to talk about. It just came from out of left field and hit me in the side of the head like a kick from a mule. And when I responded to him, the only way I could, I knew I couldn't BS him. I mean, you didn't want to BS Ted Turner. He had a pretty good BS meter. You know, the only thing I could say was, "Look, Ted, we're on Saturday night, 6:05 Eastern, 3:05 Pacific time, and WWE is on prime time coast to coast on Monday nights." And that was a fact, but that was the only thing I could think of. Not thinking for a millisecond that he would say, "Okay, great, then let's go prime time head-to-head with WWE. I probably would have tried to think on my feet and come up with a different answer if I thought that he was going to go in that direction. And that's exactly what he did. And he looked me right in the eye, along with Scott Stafford, who was really the heir apparent to the Turner organization at the time. Looked right at Scott Sasser and looked at me and said, "All right, Scott, you're there 2 hours every night, head-to-head up against WWE." I went, oh, I'm in trouble now. That was the most memorable. And I think, you know, that moment has pretty much defined professional wrestling as we've known it since that time. Because that decision by Ted Turner, and I would like to take credit for it, trust me, I wish I could. But that decision by Ted Turner changed the history of professional wrestling in a positive way to this day. You know, you look at how you know, Vince McMahon and the people that worked there would just, they're going to hate reading this if they ever do, but it's true. Had Ted Turner not made that decision, had Nitro not become, you know, what it became, had there not been a Monday Night War, I think that there is a good chance that there might not be a WWE today. Because that Monday Night War raised the level of interest in professional wrestling to a height that up until that point no one had ever imagined possible. That conflict that people refer to as that competitive era that people now refer to as the Monday Night Wars raised the level of interest in professional wrestling well beyond the traditional hardcore fan and well into the mainstream. And I think that is in part, arguably, from my perspective, in large part, why the WWE, at least one of the reasons why the WWE is as successful today as they are. Because they rose to the occasion, they changed their product, they changed the way their product was presented. They had to in order to compete with me or Nitro. And in so doing, they elevated their own brand and were able to grow from a base that up until that point they had never experienced. So I think it's fair to say that decision by Ted Turner probably benefited Vince McMahon more than anybody cares to acknowledge.
Well, that kind of speaks to my next question, because I was going to ask you, what was the moment where you thought or you knew that you could be or were going to beat Vince McMahon in WWE and become the biggest wrestling company in the world?
I never thought that going in. My goal, and I, you know, people hear me say this and they're going to read this, and they're going to go, "Oh, he's lying. He's not telling the truth." And that's probably because they've been fed this narrative for so long that my only goal was to put the WWF out of business, which isn't true. Not true at all. But they're going to believe it. And they've been fed that line for the last 20 years, and now they're so committed to believing it that it's hard for them to believe anything else. That's just human nature. But all I wanted to do was survive. Again, I didn't go into Ted Turner and ask him for a two-hour show to go head-to-head with the WWF because I thought I could be number one and I thought I could put WWF out of business. It was the farthest thing from my mind. And in fact, when I was told by Ted, mandated by Ted, to launch a second show, I was scared to death because I knew it was going to be almost impossible. Because of the fact that WWF was so strong, they'd been around for decades and decades and decades, and he had such a loyal following, and they had a dense audience in the northeast part of the United States, which from a television point of view makes them very difficult to compete with because there's just such a density of population that are reflected in the ratings. I just knew I knew I was up against Goliath. And my goal, honestly, was just to be competitive. That's what Ted wanted. And competitive was, you know, just show up and put up a good fight. That's competitive. He didn't say, "Eric, what's it going to take to beat WWE?" He said, "What's it going to take to be competitive?" So that's all I wanted. I wanted to prove that we could compete. I wanted to prove that we could create a product that may not beat the WWE or F at the time, but it could at least be competitive and stand on its own 2 feet. And it wasn't until probably, 8 or 10 weeks in when the ratings started to really reflect that not only could we be competitive, but hey, if we kept doing what we were doing and utilize a new formula and utilize a new way of presenting the product and break the paradigm, and to use a term that, you know, is kind of trendy now, to disrupt, you know, the traditional wrestling format that had been established for decades on television. If we could come in and disrupt that environment in a way that people found compelling, we could be competitive, and maybe, just maybe, we might actually be able to eke out a win every now and then. But that wasn't until, you know, a couple months in, quite honestly. Up until that point, all I wanted to do was not become embarrassed.
Well, mission accomplished. Had you, if obviously a few years later, had you been able to buy WCW? I'm just curious, did you have anybody in mind at that point? Like, who would you have picked as your top guys, good guy and bad guy?
Oh, you know, I honestly, I didn't give that a lot of thought. As we were in the process of acquiring WCW from Turner Broadcasting, or AOL Time Warner, at that time it was really Time Warner, the focus was really more on tactics and strategy. And we hadn't really thought too much about talent at that point, because it was clear, and again, you have to kind of go back and put yourself in that moment and to really understand the context. The brand, WCW, had been battered and bruised and beaten about for so long. Probably by that time, we were about 2 years into that brand just being assaulted in every way it could be, you know, from creative, some of which was my fault, from brand building, some of that was AOL Time Warner's fault, to the aggressive competition that WWE was providing in the way they captured or recaptured the audience that we had established, that 18 to 34-year-old demo, when they changed their strategy and they changed the way they presented their content. They went even further than we did with some of the gratuitous violence and the sexual things and a lot of the things that people tend to want to forget about that WWE was doing that were really, you know, from Stone Cold Steve Austin getting up on the ring post, you know, on a live television show and flipping off the audience and drinking a beer. You know, that, you know, we say that, you know, in a conversation, we go, oh, well, that's really not that bad. But at that point, you know, that was something that Turner wasn't willing to even go near. You know, when you see, you know, the divas, as they referred to them, you know, provocatively dressed, almost naked, you know, being walked around the ring on a collar and leash like a dog, you know, they were doing that to push the envelope in order to get that 18 to 34-year-old male demo back. But those are things that WCW wasn't willing and able to do. So between our own misfires and miscalculations, creatively and business-wise, between the WWE raising the level of heat with regards to the type of content that they were producing to attract our audience. When I say our, that was the previously, you know, that was the demo and the audience, the market share that we previously had because of the nature of our product. All of those things combined really took a toll on the brand. So our focus, Fusion Media, myself, Brian Bedell, Steve Greenberg, our focus was, okay, how do we repair the brand? How do we reimagine the way we're going to tour and produce our television shows so that we can do so and maintain that larger-than-life kind of presentation without the expense of traveling all over the country the way we had been doing, because we were losing money doing that. So there was a lot more of those conversations taking place than who should we make the world heavyweight champion. That was kind of an after. That was phase two, if you will. Phase one was really all tactics and strategies.
I got you. I got two more for you. How did you feel about, or how do you feel about WWE Network's distribution and curation of the WCW content?
I'm grateful for it. I think most guys like me who, you know, are in the twilight of their careers or even past the twilight, who aren't really involved in the business and probably won't be again directly, we all still have an amazing time going around the country, meeting fans at different events, WrestleCons or some of them. And this is like a Comic-Con for wrestling fans, autograph signings. There are events every weekend taking place where guys like me, including, you know, Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan, are going to be doing a big event June 9th in Fort Lauderdale at the Hard Rock Cafe. Now, they're in a category all of their own. I'm not comparing myself to them. But there are still a lot of events like that that take place every weekend. And they're populated. You know, the fans are fans that weren't even around back when Nitro was in its heyday. I have 18, 19, 20, 25-year-old fans coming up to me all the time wearing NWO shirts and wanting to talk to me about what happened when, you know, something that occurred in 1997. Well, they weren't even alive then. You know, but now, because of the WWE Network, they can go back and they can see Nitro. They can see old WCW Saturday night shows. All of that content is available to them so that they can go back and become fans of something that they weren't even alive when it made its first run. And I think that's great. I love that. This stuff people will remember Sting and Ric Flair and, you know, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat and all these guys that were such an important part of the industry back in the 80s and the 90s. They'll be watching that stuff forever because of the WWE Network. And I don't know how anybody could not be excited about that, quite frankly.
Definitely. And my last one for you, just to follow up on your near purchase of WCW, what was your initial reaction to the sale of WCW to WWE, particularly the price that it was sold for? I mean, do you look back on that? Were you at peace with it pretty quickly after that, or is it something you look back on and still kind of think what could have been?
Again, I don't look back and think what could have been, because it's a rabbit hole that you can find yourself in and not be able to find your way out of if you're not careful. I think too many people make that mistake in their lives in general. I'm not talking about just, you know, a business transaction. I can reflect back and go, okay, what was I really feeling when I found out? And I was angry. I was disappointed, obviously. You know, we offered $67 million for a property that was decimated for a lot of reasons that I've already mentioned, and were ready, willing, and able, and have the resources both financially and from an executive standpoint. You know, one of my partners, Brian Badalla, is probably one of the most successful sports and television people in the industry. He created ESPN Sports Classic, for God's sake. He did much the same thing for CBS Sports. So they not only had the financial resources, they had the pedigree in entertainment and television and finance to make it work. So clearly I was disappointed that opportunity wasn't going to be available to me to actually turn that company around with some really smart people who were really committed to it, which AOL Time Warner never was. They didn't want WCW in the books. You know, one of the things that I do have to butt up against on a regular basis, because it's the nature of fans, it's the nature of, I guess, our culture to a degree. And again, the narrative is, you know, Eric Bischoff, you know, ran WCW into the ground, or Vince Russo killed WCW, or this guy killed it, or this, that wrestling match, that wrestling story is what killed WCW. It's such a naive, juvenile, uninformed point of view, but nevertheless, it's the narrative that's out there that, you know, we come up, you know, head-to-head with it quite often. The truth is, the fact is, that AOL Time Warner did not want WCW on their books. They didn't want it as a part of the AOL Time Warner portfolio, regardless of how successful it was or wasn't. If Steven Spielberg would have come in and said, I want to run WCW, and I'm going to make movies, and I want to get your ratings up, they wouldn't have done it because they didn't want it. And that's the nature of television. You know, there are networks out there that they brand themselves according to a type of content. It's a generalization, but it's a type of, you know, TBS was the comedy network for a long time. TNT was, you know, we know drama. That was a brand position. Well, wrestling wasn't comedy, and it wasn't drama. It was its own little unique, oddly shaped duck over in the corner, and AOL Time Warner didn't want that oddly shaped duck, no matter how successful it was. So that the prevailing, you know, opinion that any one person or any one match or any one storyline or whatever is what killed WCW is, it's a false narrative. It's just not true. What's true is it got caught up, like many businesses. Look at where CNN is today. There was a time prior to the AOL Time Warner merger when CNN, nobody could touch CNN. Nobody could touch CNN. Now, Nickelodeon beats them in the ratings every week. And that's just one example other than WCW of what can happen with big mergers. So we do come up across that. And when I do, I do sometimes get animated and a little defensive. But the only thing I can remember thinking was, wow, what a blown opportunity. What a blown opportunity. I knew what was going to – I didn't know. I had a pretty good idea what I thought was going to happen to WCW when WWF bought them. They weren't certainly going to try to resurrect the brand that almost put them out of business. They had a decidedly different point of view on the wrestling culture than WCW did, and they weren't going to do anything to resurrect that brand and more importantly, align it with the culture or the point of view that made WCW successful. They weren't going to do that. I knew that they were going to buy it to bury it, and that's exactly what they did.
Well, Eric Bischoff, thanks so much for taking the time to talk. I'm, you know, kind of like Conrad, I definitely come at this with a fan's perspective, and I've long admired so much of what you have done and continue to do for the business. Best of luck to you with 83 weeks. I can't wait to see where it goes and everything else. It's been an honor to talk to you.
Thank you, my friend. Good to talk to you, too.
Rammer Slammer is produced and edited by Ben Flanagan for the Alabama Media Group and AL.com. Find us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at Rammer Slammer. Thanks for listening.